This is Gina Marie Rodriguez, and you're listening to the Jersey Arts Podcast. Musical theater nerds, myself included, can rejoice. George Street Playhouse is bringing back Tick, Tick, Boom, the posthumously produced musical from Jonathan Larson, best known for having written the widely known rock opera, Rent. For those less familiar with the theater scene, you may know the name Tick, Tick, Boom thanks to Netflix's 2021 film adaptation, wherein Andrew Garfield gave an Oscar-nominated performance for his role as Jonathan Larson himself. Sadly, Larson passed away before he was able to see success. Rent became a Broadway hit and has gone on to receive both critical and audience acclaim. It wasn't until after the success of Rent that Larson's friend and producer, Victoria Leacock, sought to revive what had begun as a rock monologue. With the help of author David Auburn, what was once a one-man show was turned into a three-person musical. George Street Playhouse artistic director David Saint was also a close friend of Jonathan Larson, and to honor his friend, almost 30 years since his passing, Saint is directing a new production of Tick, Tick, Boom. Now, as a big fan of Larson's work, I am so thrilled to have had the opportunity to speak with director David Saint and the star of the show, Daniel Marconi, to learn about the history, joy, and tragedy that led to the Tick, Tick, Boom we know today. If you loved the film but have never seen the show on stage, now's your chance. And if you've been a fan for years, you can celebrate another opportunity to enjoy the life and music of Jonathan Larson in person. To get the inside scoop on the evolution of this show and laugh at my poor attempts to flirt with a leading man, check out my interview with David and Daniel.
I would love to chat about Tick, Tick, Boom. I mean, it's one of my favorite shows. I happen to love the music of Jonathan Larson. So I'm really excited about this. So hi, gentlemen. How are you? It's very nice to meet you.
I'm David, the director, and this is my star, Daniel Marconi, playing Jonathan. So I guess, I don't know if you know my history with Jonathan.
I know that you knew him. I know that you've been around this show since its inception, really.
Yes, I worked on it originally with John, and he played himself in it, and we did it three different times. It had three different titles. It was first called 30/90, and then it was called Boho Days. That song's not even in it anymore. There was a song.
The demo track is still on the
Bohemia.
Put it back in the movie.
Oh my God! Yeah. So that's that was, but we cut it from the show. But that was the second title, and finally, it ended up with Tick, Tick, Boom as the title. And just so you know, I was working on Rent with Jonathan for 6 years, and I brought it to every theater in New York. I mean, all the big nonprofit theaters, and everybody said no. And finally, I got a call. I was in Seattle doing a show, and Jonathan called and said, somebody finally said yes, New York Theater Workshop. And they had a workshop fall out, and they want to do it. I said, that's fantastic. He said, the only bad news is they want to start rehearsal in 2 weeks, and you're out of town for six more weeks, so I don't know what to do. I said, you do it. You get a different director, and you do it. So that's what happened. And then, of course, I talked to him almost every night. And the night before I flew in to see the first performance of Rent, like an hour after we talked on the phone, he died. You know, so when I flew in the next day, I landed and I was told what had happened, and it was just, you know, it was a Greek tragedy. He never saw the show in front of an audience, and then he never certainly saw what the show became. You know, Jonathan lived in this play, Tick, Tick, Boom. It's all about his life, where he shared an apartment at 508 Greenwich Avenue, where I was many times there. And he shared it with like four other people, revolving roommates. And it was a railroad flat with the bathtub in the kitchen and, you know, these struggling young artists with no money. And then after Jonathan died, he became a multi-millionaire, but he never saw any of it. I worked on this a long time ago with Jonathan, and now, you know, he's been gone almost 30 years. So I really wanted to do it again. As a tribute to him in his memory. And the hardest part was finding someone to play Jonathan, because they have to have the essence of Jonathan. And even though this fellow doesn't look anything like Jonathan, he has Jonathan's spirit.
And ADHD.
Well, that's what's important.
Exactly. Yes, and ADHD. They're both ADHD.
Well, again, ADHD advocates, let's just talk about that as well.
That's right.
But so, let me ask Daniel, I mean, what is it like for you to be playing someone who's so important in, you know, in the theater culture?
Yeah, I mean, to me, I'm not looking at it as playing the guy who wrote Rent. We talked about that a lot early on, how like we generally market Tick Tick Boom as like the story behind the man who created Rent or the creation of Rent or anything like that. But in reality, you know, it was written before all that happened. This was all a rock monologue that he performed alone, not knowing what was to come. And so I try not to look at it with any kind of like hindsight bias on it. And then what you're left with is a 29-year-old, which I'm 29, struggling artist in New York. I am a struggling artist in New York. And he's simultaneously so specific and also so universal about the just pursuit of a career in the arts.
And like combined with today, we just finished working on Therapy, which is the number between him and his girlfriend. And, you know, I knew the lady who inspired the part of Susan. Her name's not Susan. Her name is Janet. And I also knew his best friend, his gay friend who got AIDS. And he is still alive, the best friend. But back then in 1990. Thankfully, yes. But in 1990, we all thought if you were diagnosed with AIDS, you were dead, mm-hmm. like 3 years, maybe tops. Right. But then he lived right at that time when the drug cocktail started. And so he survived. And ironically and tragically, Jonathan's the one who died.
Yeah.
I've thought about that before. It is tragic.
It's the ultimate Greek tragedy, as he has said so many times. And this takes place 5 years into, let me think about this timeline for a second. Where this takes place, he's been working on a show for 8 years, right? And he's been living in this apartment at 508 with all these roommates, not even in his own bedroom, in a curtained off section of the living room with nothing but his keyboard and
mattress on the floor
and cat and a litter box, which I've lived. I've lived in a studio with a litter box and it's not ideal. And like how tragic is it that even after this story and through his death for 6 more years, he lived in that apartment.
Yeah, he never moved out of that apartment.
He was at that apartment when he passed.
And he was working at, cause I worked with him on Rent for about 6 years. So they do actually overlap in the sense that while he was doing Superbia, which is the show that gets done in Tick, Tick, Boom that he's working on, he was also working on Rent. And I was telling them that I did a show called Billy Bishop Goes to War in New Jersey in Teaneck at the American Stage, which no longer exists. A two-character play, Billy Bishop, who was played by Roger Bart, and the piano player who played all the other roles was Jonathan Larson. And the three of us would drive his little Volkswagen BM Beetle back and forth to Manhattan. And Jonathan would give Roger and me lines of a song like Santa Fe, that song in Rent that he was composing at the time. And he would say this and using that. And he would. So, and Roger Bart was actually the first public reading that Rent had was Roger playing Roger. And Jonathan named the part after Roger as Roger Bart. Because in Bohème, it's Rudolfo, you know. So he kept the others named the way they were named in the original. But Mimi, you know, is Mimi. But Rudolfo became Roger because of Roger Bart.
I love these stories. It's just so nice to hear all of the backstories.
You know, the history. And of course, when they ended up doing it, finally, Roger was too old to play the part.
Oh, another tragedy, really.
Yeah, I know. So, but there it goes. It's all history now. And so much in this, I mean, when you talk about the workshop of doing Superbia. It was at Playwrights Horizons, and he talks about his agent, Flora Roberts, who I knew well, and she was there. I was there at that workshop because I was working on Tick, Tick, Boom with him at the time. So it's crazy. It's crazy.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy how time flies, too. You know, I remember having seen this show on stage many years ago now. I'm guessing over a decade. I loved it then. And then when I heard about, you know, the Netflix adaptation, of course, I was really excited to see what they were going to do with it. But then they cut out my favorite song. I was very upset. That's they fun. Cut out Green, Green Dress.
Green, Green Dress.
Oh, I know. They choreographed it just yesterday or the day before, and it's so sexy, baby. And it's so fun.
We're
and
back.
The two of them.
I love that. I'm going to have to go just to see that.
Exactly. You know, I remember when we did it originally, when the show was over and people walked out of the theater, they played Green, Green Dress as the exit music because it was so catchy. And
oh, yeah.
Went out singing it, you know. It's a great number.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as a musical theater nerd, I think because green is my color, I just imagine some man singing it to me one day. It hasn't happened yet, but one day.
There's time.
There's time.
Time. But, oh, no. You gotta come for that.
Exactly. He can't give us a preview now. I have to
come. No way. I need to lyrics first.
Absolutely. And also the thing that's different if people have seen the movie is that the stage show is a whole different creature because one of the great things about the stage show, Jonathan subtitled it a rock monologue because he wanted it to be feel like a rock, like Eric Bogosian was just doing his monologues at that time he's starting, and also John Leguizamo, and Jonathan loved both of them. And this was his sort of musical version of that, you know, to do a monologue that was edgy and funny and passionate, but with music. And he wanted to bridge rock and roll music with show music. But what the great thing about the play that the movie doesn't do is that all these other characters are played by two actors. And that's such a delight to watch these actors become all these other characters. Yeah. Whereas in the movie, they just hired a whole bunch of actors to play every single role, which is fine, but it takes away the theater fun of it, you know?
No, I'm very excited to see that. I mean, even as an actor, it's got to be so exciting just to be able to play multiple roles within one show. You know, building your resume in one shot.
They were saying that in rehearsal that they get to do so much in this show because there's a lot of comedy. I mean, it's very funny. And thank God I have three actors who are really funny. And so that part of it works beautifully as a comedy. And then you have the music and they all sing incredibly. And this one was just on Broadway in Sweeney Todd.
Saw that. That's exciting. Yeah. But I was going to ask you about that. Oh, sorry, Daniel, what?
I just acknowledged that it was indeed exciting.
Yeah. Oh, my question about that was going to be, what is it like to be a part of such, I mean, Sweeney Todd is like a much larger ensemble. So how does that environment change affect you from being part of such a large cast to one of three?
Yeah, I mean, it's so different in so many ways. But I think I longed for the intimacy of projects like this. I come from a play background more than from a musical background. So I come from generally smaller pieces, most of the stuff that I cut my teeth on. And I mean, already you've seen like a week and a half in less, we are already getting extremely close in a way that you kind of can't. It's much harder in a setting when you have a massive ensemble, but it's so tight knit when it's just the three of us, and it's lovely. I mean, they're such wonderful folks.
He was replacing in Sweeney Todd too, which is a different thing because, you know, you're not creating it with the original cast. You know, you're going into a role that's already been played.
And you rehearse it alone for the most part.
Yeah.
I was like, you learn it all just by yourself.
And the stage manager.
And then you get one put in rehearsal where you do the show in your costume while everyone else just kind of walks around in street clothes. The most disorienting thing you can imagine. But But yeah, this is nothing like that. And it's the opposite. And it's lovely. They're both wonderful, but
in their own ways.
This is the thing that I long for.
And also you're going not shabby, Sondheim and Larson.
No, I mean, yeah.
Those are absolutely.
Great, you know, artists of the musical theater.
You don't have to worry about trying to figure out how to act a lyric.
Right.
Which is so nice.
Yes, exactly. Or where it's all just generalities and moon, spoon, June, you know, or whatever the version is of that. So, I mean, they're both Jonathan and Sondheim were really exceptional lyricists. And, you know, Stephen Sondheim was Jonathan's idol, you know. So he's right in that school of the importance of the lyrics.
It's rather poetic that you've gone from Sondheim to Larson because he was his idol. So I do love that. I really wish this weren't a podcast because you're so expressive. And I wish people could see your face. But go on.
Face is so loud. My face has so many words.
In the best of ways.
Oh, well, it depends who you ask. But yeah, no, there's an entire Sondheim tribute in this show. We do Sunday, you know, and in this, it's Sunday brunch at the diner. The funny thing is, this is the one time in the show where I'd consider calling the lyrics dumb. They're brilliant in that they're just it's a dumb parody and it's so brilliant. But what's funny is even with these silly lyrics, Sondheim's melody it's exoskeleton of his orchestration just on a piano and three voices is like, it's aural ecstasy. It's amazing.
And we're just at a point in rehearsal where we only have a piano. I mean, we will have more musicians when we get into the actual show. But right now, we have a pianist and that's it. You know, but it still comes through. Don't forget, Jonathan played all this material for me in his terrible apartment with the bathtub in the kitchen and four roommates and no room. And he played on an electric piano in his apartment. That's where I first heard these songs. That's where I first heard the songs to Rent. You know, it was all in his little electric piano. And talk about, he mirrored the story of Rent. He was, like in La Boheme, he was a really poor, struggling artist living in what his father and mother called a slum, you know. And he worked in the Moondance Diner. Right up until he died. He took off from Moondance Diner as a waiter. He took off right before the workshop of Rent started. And that was his first break from the diner, and then he died. He could have bought the diner now.
He could have. But yeah. I like to believe that he can still be a part of it now. He may not be here physically and present with us, but I like to think that he's enjoying it all from afar.
Absolutely. And you know, having worked with him on it, I even in the audition, I started to cry because Jonathan was suddenly back in the room singing to me, you know, and it's a lot to handle. It's a lot to handle.
I can only imagine.
Even after all this time.
He must have just been the most beautiful heart. I mean, the thing that he told stories, our initial table work the first few days was a lot of stories about Jonathan and he told stories about, I mean, A, the fact that Jonathan was just so content living in that situation, as long as he had his music, as long as he could compose, like, he didn't care what he had to do to, you know, scrape by if it meant that he could have his piano. And also the Greyhound story.
The generosity. He would, you know, he had no money. But I was a young director, and I was directing around the country wherever I could get work. And he would just show up opening night. And I said, Jonathan, why didn't you tell me you were coming? I wanted to surprise you. Well, how did you get here? A Greyhound bus. You know, to Seattle. A Greyhound bus.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, that shows his spirit, you know.
Oh, that's such a nice story. And what a blessing it is that you, as the cast, can benefit from someone who knew Jonathan Larson. That's huge.
Oh my God, it's the ultimate dramaturgy. Yeah, it really is like unbelievable. And it gives you I think my appreciation is so much deeper for the anecdotes. You know what I mean? the reverence. It's just, yeah, we're very lucky.
It's a lot. It's a lot to, I mean, for you, David, I don't know what the nostalgia, what the emotion of that situation really is, but I hope that it's cathartic in a way to be able to
it is. And yet, you know, don't forget, I mean, I went to see Rent at the opening on Broadway, and I was there with Jonathan's parents, and we just cried through the whole thing. So that was catharsis so recently after he had passed. But now it's a different thing because, you know, I'm 30 years older. He's gone almost 30 years. And, you know, it's looking back at somebody from my youth, you know, and now I'm 30 years older. And I think, what would Jonathan have done? You know, how would fame have affected him? And how many more shows did he have in him that he could have written that we never saw? Don't forget, when the night before he died with Rent, he said, "David, I need to talk to you about the dramaturgy of the show because I'm not happy yet with how it is." And then he died and nothing was touched. So for people to realize, Jonathan was still working on the show. I mean, he was going to have a whole rehearsal period and previews to work on the show before it even dreamt of moving to Broadway. And it just took off like a rocket. But he wasn't finished. You know, I think of Sondheim's song, "Finishing the Hat," you know, and that's that he was still working on Rent, but yet it won the Tony, the Pulitzer, you know, won every award known to man.
Yeah.
And it's such a huge hit and ran like over 10 years on Broadway. And it was, you know, it goes down in the annals of history as one of the big hits of Broadway musical theater. It really changed musical theater in many ways. And that's what his dream was, but he never saw it realized, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's really heartbreaking to think about, but I mean, I'm glad that we've all been able to benefit from his work, and obviously his heart and his passion, it didn't need more work. He got it to where it needed to be in the time that he was given. And like I said before, I think he sees that now. I would like to believe that he sees that now.
Yeah. Well, so many people's lives, it has affected that show, yeah. You know. And now Tick, Tick, Boom, I'm finding, is having a resurgence. And a lot of it's due to the fact of the Netflix movie, you know, right. 2 years ago. So now it's brought it back into people's consciousness. And so I'm hoping that brings a whole new audience that haven't seen it on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Yeah. As someone who knew him, did you have thoughts on that movie? Were you happy with it? Did it pay him homage in a way you appreciated?
I loved... what's the fellow who played Jonathan?
Andrew Garfield.
He was wonderful, I thought, and very like Jonathan. I felt he really captured Jonathan. The rest of it, I have to say, I'm a fan of theater over film. Arthur Lawrence, who was my mentor, who wrote, you know, West Side Story and Gypsy, he said that theater is language of metaphor and film is literal. It's literal. It is what it is. And so it doesn't take off for me. That's why, you know, the movie of Rent didn't take off for me. The movie of Tick, Tick, Boom, it you know, it was good, mainly because of Andrew, I thought. But I just, there's something wonderful about it being a theater piece right there in front of you. You know?
I understand that. I think one of the best things about movie adaptations of theater is that so many people don't have access to theater otherwise, so they're at least introduced to this work in some way.
I now control all the properties of Arthur Lawrence. I'm the executor of his estate. So I worked on the movie of West Side Story with Steven Spielberg for 2 years. And that was an incredible experience, you know.
Yeah, so. I can only imagine. That sounds wonderful. But they filmed some of that in New Jersey, didn't they?
A little bit. We came out for New Jersey. Of course, New Jersey claims that the whole thing was shot here, right? You know,
like, we tried. Okay. Throw us a bone.
Some of it was in Brooklyn. Some of it was in a lot of it. We couldn't, nothing around the area of where West Side Story takes place was the way it was now.
No,
it's all gone. It's Lincoln Center. It's all highly developed. But we did go uptown, way uptown, and found some brownstones that were very remnant. And a lot we shot in the Bronx. the and the Bronx, the areas of the Bronx that aren't the most developed, you know, slightly dangerous areas of the Bronx. That's where we shot a lot of it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm going to pretend this conversation didn't happen and tell everyone it was filmed entirely in New Jersey anyway.
That's right. Me too.
Oh, okay. There you go.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding. But anyway, I got distracted before I mentioned my favorite song in Tick, Tick, Boom, but I didn't get to ask you guys, which I know is always a crazy question to ask someone who's actually a part of the show, but I'm going to do it anyway. Do you guys have a favorite song?
No, I'll go to you first.
Okay. Well, you know, I as someone who came up worshiping Sondheim, I get too much of a kick out of Sunday. It's so fun. It's so gorgeous and it's so fun. But because it's a parody, I don't think it really counts. So this is my way of getting two answers. Mm. I would say the original composition of choice. Oh man, Come to Your Senses in the context of this show. A, I think that chorus is the most beautiful melody.
It's a great song
in the show, but also the split function of it dramatically. Because in the show, "Come to Your Senses" is, you know, it's part of the Superbia Workshop, but it's also, you know, it can be reinterpreted as Susan singing to John, and it works. It has that split, that split effectiveness, and alongside that,
I remember when we found that song because we needed another song for Susan. We wanted a solo.
Right.
And I said to him, do you have something from one of your other shows that you love? And he said, well, from Superbia, there's a song that's my favorite. And he played it for me. And I said, that's perfect because the lyrics work both ways. It can be Susan and Caressa who's singing in the workshop of Superbia. And, you know, it's funny because, in the movie, they had a different actress sing Caressa, Come to Your Senses. And I miss that having the same person playing, so you see the dual reality of the song simultaneously.
Yeah.
And that's, again, theater, metaphor, you know, it can be both at once. You don't need a different actress to sing it or play it. So that really, but I love the song Why, because Why is really getting back to Jonathan's beginnings of why he wanted to spend his life this way. You know, what was the, you know, there's a line where he says, what a way to spend a day. And I make a vow here and now, I'm going to spend the rest of my life this way. And that was Jonathan from the time he was a kid in summer camp, you know, and
every artist too.
Yeah. So many, you know, I did a lot of interviews for George Street with different, especially during COVID, we did a lot of interviews with different artists. And I was amazed, actors, directors, designers, composers, writers, almost every one of them fell in love with the theater when they were a kid.
Mm-hmm.
When they were, their grandmother or their father or their school teacher or someone brought them to a show and they caught the bug and they fell in love with the magic of what happens in the theater. And it's amazing how many people, and successful people, they all started the same way. It always came down to, well, it was my summer camp, or I was in a high school, or I was in middle school and they took us to a play, or my grandmother took me to a Broadway matinee and, you know, I couldn't believe it. And, you know, how, no matter how old or young people are. So that's why it's so important that young people come to the theater. I have to tell you a story that's sort of sad about that. Ironic, really. We have a TV that does for the lobby if you're late and you can watch until there's an appropriate break to go in. And once I had some Rutgers students who were in a freshman class, theater appreciation, and they came and they were sitting, there were like three of them, sitting in the lobby watching the TV. And I said, you know, you can go in now, you know, it's past the late seating mark. And they said, oh no, we have to watch this for class credit. And I said, you do realize right through those doors, it's happening in person. And they had no idea. They had never seen a show. These were freshmen in college. They'd never seen a show in person. And I was stunned. I thought, how is this even possible? But, you know, it is. If people don't bring their kids to the theater, or, you know, it doesn't have to be your own kids, but, you know, through schools or whatever, that we need to introduce young people to the arts. And that's why I'm hoping that this show, Tick, Tick, Boom, doing it, I'm not young anymore, but I'll tell you, I really want young people to come and see this show. Because Jonathan was a young person when he wrote it, and it will speak to them. It will speak to them.
Well, funny enough, I do work at Rutgers as a teaching assistant for theater appreciation. So those are probably my students, but I will be pushing it to them. I have already told them to come see the show.
Yes.
And it happened that way for me too. You know, I'm a theater lover, and my first show was Phantom of the Opera. My parents brought me when I was probably 10 or so, something like that. Yeah. That's how it goes.
You got the bug.
The Meg musicals.
Yeah, I know.
Mine was Lion King.
Yours was Lion King?
Yeah. Like in 97.
I still haven't seen Lion King on Broadway, which is shocking.
The first 15 minutes are iconic. And what she did in the first 15 minutes is true magic, theater magic.
Yeah.
I know. Shame on me, right? That's it is actually.
Well, I mean,
listen, I haven't seen a lot of the big Disney shows. Where you lose me, I'm old school. I don't want to see cartoon characters on stage. I just don't want to. I don't want to see a teapot singing. And I don't want to see, you know, it's hard for me. I like shows about people.
I do too. And I say that as a Disney kid, but I agree with you.
I mean, there are a lot of people who, you know, my nieces and nephews, they love those Disney musicals. They watch them, you know, 100 times.
I get that. I watch them, you know, on TV 100 times, but I can't do that when they make these adaptations. You know what? I'm not going to trash Disney. Let's not do that. I'll go in a different direction.
I'm a Disney theatrical kid.
And my choreographer is like a Disney representative. He has everything Disney. So, I can't say anything bad about Disney.
Yeah, no. I love Disney. That's where we're going to end that. But I do have a question for you. And it's something that I haven't really asked in these podcasts before, but I noticed that George Street Playhouse is doing, or I should say you're offering, an open captioning program. Have you had that long?
Yes, we've had that a few years now. And it's very, people really appreciate it, you know. We have the audio described performances, which, you know, it's always fascinating to watch them because they come in a couple of shows early to practice, to get used to how they're going to describe. Particularly if you have a very physical show, like a farce where a lot of things are happening, it's a real workout for those people that have to tell the people listening what's going on stage because they can't see. So it's really fascinating to me. And then I also think there's a new thing now where they're doing special performances on Broadway, too, for autistic awareness.
Oh.
And they cater the show to be played in a way that won't frighten people that have autism because they watch differently. And they work very hard to communicate the show in a way that won't intimidate autistic folks.
I love that we're living in a time where we recognize how much representation matters and how we need to cater to different audiences. I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, I mean, in the last 10 years, the steps that accessibility, whether physical, literal, or some kind of mental accessibility, emotional accessibility, the steps that it's taken just in the last decade, it's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it'll continue trending in that direction.
I hope so,
too. I know our actor playing Michael, he's very proud because he's Asian. And he said, I think this is I'm the first Asian who's played this. So I'm not sure because I don't know all the productions, but he feels a great pride in being able to play Michael as an Asian, you know.
I love that. It's so important. I push representation all the time. Representation does matter. I mean, I'm a white Latina, but it was still really exciting when I was a kid and I saw the movie Selena and I was like, oh my God, that's J-Lo. She's a Puerto Rican like me. That's so cool. But yeah.
Did you appreciate in the in the movie of West Side Story, how I loved the fact that some scenes were in the Puerto Ricans spoke in Spanish and they didn't even use subtitles.
Yes.
Just assumed that the audience, the non-Spanish speaking audience, would get it from the scene, what was going on.
And they did. I mean, it was easy to, well, I say that as somebody who did understand it, but I think it was, you know, I was able to take my dad to see that film before he passed. And that was, it was just really nice to be able to see that representation on screen with my dad, who grew up in that era. My father was much older, so he did actually grow up in the times that West Side Story was set. But I digress. I don't know how we got there. I'm sorry about that.
Representation.
Yes, representation. Yeah. It was representation. We talked about so much. I feel like we covered a lot. But is there anything that you gentlemen would like to say to audiences to encourage them to see this show?
Well, I think it runs the gamut. It's a very young show, so it has tremendous energy. It has humor and passion, and the music is great. I mean, it's unusual because, you know, now, I mean, Lin-Manuel Miranda, you know, talks about Jonathan Larson as his, in one of his inspirations, because Jonathan did bring the sound of rock into a more conservative showbiz sound. And Lin has gone on and done the same thing with rap, you know.
Yeah. It's also, as we mentioned earlier, speaking of accessibility, ADHD accessibility. I mean, this is like, it's like a one long, one 80-minute ADHD fever dream, which for someone like me and most of my generation with our, you know, 10-second attention spans, he had that too. And it's written that way where it'll go from a dramatic scene straight into a,
And like people switching characters instantly on a dime. You know, that's very ADHD. Yeah.
It's perfect for the neurospicy crowd. That's
exactly. Good. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It's perfect for the current generation.
You won't get bored.
Myself included.
It moves very quickly.
That's a good sell. I'm looking forward to it because I'm going to pretend that you're singing Green Green Dress to me when I'm there.
Oh, I will. To be cautious, I'll sing it to you every show. And then whenever you're there, you'll know.
Thank you so much. This is what I'm looking forward to now. Like, it will make my life, and I will wear a green dress. Now I have to buy myself
a green dress. Excellent. I need the inspiration.
I actually have a green gown. Does that count? Can I wear a green gown?
It's not green gown. So no, I don't know. We'll make the final judgment when you come.
I mean, what do we define a dress? It's just floor length. That's all. I think it's still a dress. Whatever. Right. We're going to pretend and you're going to sing to me and then we're going to get married and it's all good.
It's going to be a privilege.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. This has been a wonderful talk.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's been wonderful talking to you. And I look forward to seeing you at the show.
Tick, Tick, Boom will run April 23rd through May 19th at the George Street Playhouse in New Brunswick. Special open caption performances will take place on May 4th, with English captioning at the 2 p.m. matinee and Spanish captioning at the 8 p.m. performance. And for those Rutgers students out there, George Street is offering a special student discount. This offer is specific to those attending Rutgers University. To take advantage, call the GSP box office at 732-246-7717. For more information, be sure to visit georgestreetplayhouse.org. If you liked this episode, be sure to review, subscribe, and tell your friends. A transcript of this podcast, links relevant to the story, and more about the arts in New Jersey can be found at jerseyarts.com. The Jersey Arts Podcast is presented by Art Pride New Jersey, advancing a state of creativity since 1986. This show was co-founded by and currently supported by funds from the New Jersey State Council on the Arts, with additional support from the National Endowment for the Arts. This episode was hosted, edited, and produced by me, Gina Marie Rodriguez. Executive producers are Jim Atkinson and Isaac Serna Diaz. And my thanks to today's guests, David Saint and Daniel Marconi, for their time today. I'm Gina Marie Rodriguez for the Jersey Arts Podcast. Thanks for listening.